And we return 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Bonnie, perhaps we can get on that asteroid mission in 2021. Well, this hour we visit with journalist and longtime television figure Jane Pauley. Of course, she was anchor on both the Today Show and NBC Dateline. Jane Pauley's written a second book as well. It's Your Life Calling, Reimagining the Rest of Your Life, and she joins us from New York City. How's the weather up there, Jane?
I got about a foot of snow out my window. Got real lucky coming from Philadelphia. Got an early train despite a blizzard. Then it took me 2.5 hours to go 10 blocks.
But you're coming to Miami tomorrow, right?
I'm really looking forward to it.
It's a little chilly here, though. It's a little chillier than
usual.
Oh, yes,
we're just shivering here.
Don't talk to me about chilly. I know what temperature you got.
Okay. I do just want to say that Jane Pauley is giving the keynote speech at the Women's Chamber of Commerce luncheon tomorrow at 11 a.m. at the Biltmore. But evidently, it sold out.
According to the website.
But if you'd like to be placed on the event waiting list, you can do so. Just go to their website, womenschamberofcommerce.org, and they'll notify you if there are cancellations.
Or maybe there's some standing room or something.
Something like that. Yeah.
Ooh, standing room.
Standing room only.
Yeah. Patricia Ireland is also being honored. So I don't think I can solely take credit, and I think the organization is worthy, and people go to see each other, but still,
yes,
sounds pretty good to my ear.
Well, so Jane, you tell all these stories about other people in your life calling, but let's begin with your story and your groundbreaking career, which began when you were just 25 years old, when you said you were just too young to be scared. So how did that happen?
Oh, I was scared enough. I think I was too young to know how scared I ought to be. And how it happened was a question that loomed over me and my appreciation of my career for, one or two decades or so. Mm. Long before anyone else, was still thinking about, how old I was, because I only stayed 25 for a few weeks, and then 26 and 30, and then everything else happened. But it was still, for someone, I'm from the Midwest, and feet on the ground, and it was a movie kind of scenario that was inconsistent with the way I lived my life. That of all the people who would, and someone who would say replace Barbara Walters, and I jump in and say, no one replaces Barbara Walters. But I was sitting in the chair that she had recently vacated on the Today Show, and I was 25 years old. To put it in even more ridiculous context, as someone who had lacked a journalism degree or experience, I had worked in my hometown, Indianapolis, on television for 3 years. 1 year before I arrived on the Today Show, I was anchoring the Big News Weekend Edition in Indianapolis. 1 year. Mm. And I really can't explain it, except that I am a leading-edge baby boomer. I was out of the in the job market in 1972, the year the FCC added a couple of key words to a paragraph on affirmative action regarding local TV station licensing, and those two words were, and women.
Mm-hmm.
I was a girl, but I think being, a leading-edge baby boomer, as millions of young women like me were leaving college and taking for granted that, we would enter the work world in a way our mothers and grandmothers hadn't, and there I was, standing near the head of the line, and so I am old enough now that I stop talking too much about how lucky I was at 63. I'll look back and think, give yourself a little credit.
Right.
Opportunity was always in a tent parked outside my front door and ringing the doorbell when I needed it. But I did have the courage to answer the door, say yes, and, you know, I made it took advantage of what opportunities were there right up until I had a daytime show in my mid-50s, which I will forgive you for never having seen because you were working, and not enough people did see it. I was opposite someone you may have heard of, Oprah. and when that show was not picked up after the first year, though my psyche does want it mentioned that it was the number one new show of the season, it wasn't picked up, and I kind of was waiting around a little bit for the opportunity thing to happen like it always did, but it didn't. And time passed. People would ask, Jane, what are you up to these days? And my husband, Gary, would roll his eyes because he knew I would be saying,
Gary Trudeau,
oh, I'm just basically unemployed. And then people started asking how I was enjoying retirement. Mm-hmm. I was not retired. I actually was working the problem, sitting exactly where I am talking to you now on the sofa in my living room, which was sort of my R&D center during that period when I really was looking for what I would do. And I'll let you get a question in a moment, but I'm kind of leading. I feel myself leading to a piece in the book that, and you are right, it's mostly about other people, but my story is involved. I got a message in my inbox one morning. Dear Mom, and to sum it up, it was my son Tom, my youngest, he would have been 23, 24 at the time, saying, I think you've surveyed the field long enough, thinking about what you might like to do, what you'd be good at, what your options are. I think it's time to make your move. And I'm not telling that story saying, and my son inspired me, da-da-da-da-da. It wasn't quite like that because he really didn't appreciate how actively I was trying to make a move. But that's sort of what my book is about. It's about those moments in life where, life for most of us does sort of happen, and then all of a sudden, as to quote one of the women in my book, Sue Halpern, we get shaken out of our routines, something happens, and then we have to find out, you know, what our capacities are.
Jane Pauley, I'm sorry, Jane Pauley, getting back to your early career, you say when you were younger you suffered from imposter syndrome, if you could describe it. Also, someone called you a hood ornament when you were young.
Yeah, yes. I got a big new job in Chicago when I was 24. I was to become the first woman to anchor an evening news program in Chicago, which is probably, in terms of local news, the most serious news town in the country. Front page, Mike Royko. I mean, and it took itself and its news very seriously. And this youngster from Indian No Place, which I think they would have called it, was showing up to deliver their news. And this was not good news. And the local press gave me a rip-roaring welcome, including the TV critic who, and this, mind you, was before I had packed a bag. I hadn't left Indianapolis yet. He reported that I had the IQ of a cantaloupe, and that's what got it started. And then the guy at the other newspaper compared me to a hood ornament. That was how I was introduced to Chicago. I was racing ahead to the rest of my life, and you've taken me all the way back.
We've taken you back.
I was still wearing braces on my teeth. I still had, on my back, molars. There was a picture of me on the front page of the Saturday Evening Post, which some of your listeners may remember, and I was the cover, and my orthodontist had retired to Florida and noticed that in my, lovely smile, give my parents credit for the orthodontia, he can make out those molars on my back teeth that I sort of hadn't gotten around to removing. He suggested that it was time.
That's funny. You know, if you don't mind staying back there just a little, because this brings me to a question I have about today. When you were talking about your Today Show job or whatever came to an end, you said that you weren't fitting into NBC's strategic future. What did that mean?
I thought like that. You know, for many years, can't explain why, I have read the Harvard Business Review. And I'm interested in organizations and management and leadership and how, you know, how organizations behave. And I think what I was really looking for, though this was sort of recreational for me, was helping NBC learn how to deploy my skills and interests to mutual benefit. And so I was kind of trying to strategically think about how my career in NBC could live, you know, happily together. So that's why I would have used a word, a term like strategic plan. But the fact was, I had been there for 13 years. I had worked with Tom Brokaw for 5 years. I'd been with Bryant Gumbel on the sofa anchoring the show for 8. When Deborah Norville appeared, and she was 10 years younger, beautiful, very smart, very talented, and if NBC didn't do something for her with her, some other network would. And so I think they kind of blundered in rushing her, you know, into the spotlight in such a way that I read, and most other people did too, that my successor had arrived. So I suggested to NBC privately, I think my successor has arrived, and how about, you know, you throw me a farewell party and we'll pass the torch. 13 years is a long time. I think it was a record at that time. I was the longest host the Today Show had ever had. So I didn't fault NBC for thinking about the future. My son Tom, who I've already referred to, when he first started doing fantasy baseball, told me if I was on his team, he said, if you weren't productive, Mom, I'd trade you in a heartbeat. You know, the fact is, it's business.
But you were productive.
You know, well, yeah, but I don't know what the algorithm was for future success. And, you know, I actually was important to the program in a demographic that the numbers at the time would have suggested that in particular with women, I was an important factor in the show. But at the time, the ratings were falling. We had very serious competition from Good Morning America, which didn't exist. That when I arrived as a 25-year-old, Good Morning America, which, you know, you think of, you know, in the same context with the Today, hadn't happened yet. So now viewers had an option, and I don't know who it was doing. Was it David Hartman there? Joan London was there. And, you know, they were really tearing things up. And so, you know, you got to change things to keep up with the times. And I wasn't asked to leave, but I was kind of, I could see I wasn't part of the strategic plan. Mm. And I had a future that I was thinking about, and to protect, you know, my own brand, if you will, young Jane, I was probably in my late 30s, I thought, you know, it would really be better if I just thanked NBC for these wonderful years.
Were you very good at going to breaks when guests were talking?
I was awful.
Well, we have one.
I thought we could get some tips.
That was very... Are we going to a break? Because that was super smooth.
Yes, we are. Yeah. We are speaking with Jane Pauley. Her latest book is Your Life Calling, Reimagining the Rest of Your Life. And we have lots more questions, and we'll take some calls and emails. But first, let's take that break. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Great to have you, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Jane Pauley, longtime anchor and host on NBC and had her own show, The Jane Pauley Show. Her latest book is Your Life Calling, Reimagining the Rest of Your Life. Would you like to join in the conversation? You can call us 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or email radio at WLRN.org. And before we move on, Jane, I just want to ask you, because you mentioned, Jane, that Deborah Norville was 10 years your junior and all that. Do you think in broadcasting, being younger is still operative? Has it changed? Has it shifted at all?
Or gotten worse?
I really don't have a qualified answer to that, except to say that Barbara Walters keeps talking about retirement, but, you know, she's 83 and still, That's right. Leads the majors. Diane Sawyer, I think, is in her late 60s. Katie Couric is, you know, doing that Yahoo thing, and Katie's, you know, well into her 50s. So there are examples. Judy Woodruff, you know, and Gwen Ifill on the NewsHour, and
Christian Amanpour isn't that young.
I love these people. So there are lots of veterans. Though on the other hand, you know, there are so many platforms in news today I look at the younger women I see on cable, especially, and I think I couldn't get a job today. You know, with thousands of women competing for a job instead of hundreds, I don't think I could. But I would not have foreseen that women in their 60s, 70s, 80s would still be working. I certainly wouldn't have foreseen that I would be being interviewed on NPR by people who have said that I have written my second book. Never saw that coming.
It seems like on the local TV stations, the news crews and the anchors are that very young and very
well. They were then too.
Model looking like models.
Well, I was. Look at me. I was 21. I just turned 22 when I'd started in television, and I was anchoring the weekend news at 22, 23. If I had a co-host, he was 10. 20 or 30 years older than I was. I mean, that was the co-ed anchor teams back in the 70s and early 80s. There typically was a generational divide between the anchor man and his anchor woman partner. But, you know, time passes, and we do grow up and we do get older. So I think it's a mix. I think the answer is yes and no and others.
Well, let's move on to your book. Why don't we? Why do you prefer the term reimagine rather than reinvent?
Wasn't my idea, but it was a better idea.
Okay.
I first used the word reinvention in a speech, at least my first documented use of it. I was 39, and it was the graduating class at Radcliffe, and I'm using the word reinvention. So I've been thinking about this topic forever. Change interests me. The future is kind of where I dwell. I'm not a Pollyanna. That would be my sister, Ann Pauley. But I'm not the family optimist, and yet I have a confidence that whatever the future brings, especially now, as I am a mature woman, that I have the life experience, skills, that whatever it brings, I will adapt to it, which is a kind of confidence in the future. So I've been interested in reinvention for a long time, though not everyone embraces change as I do. The person I married, for instance, though he is capable of doing many different things. I mean, he's doing a television program, if you can call it that, for Amazon now, in addition to cartooning. Gary, you know, has had a very varied career. But if we move the furniture, he'll move it back. He calls me the change agent. He is not. So a lot of people aren't as interested in change and reinvention as I am, and find that word a little scarifying.
I see.
It implies too much change. Reinvention sounds like extreme makeover, you know, and who wants that? Not many. So I work with AARP, Your Life Calling series, which was rebranded Life Reimagined. I created it. I invented it. Took it to the Today Show. AARP and I have been partners now for going on 5 seasons. But they did the research as an organization that discovered people weren't that comfortable with the word reinvention. But reimagined, once I heard it, I just embraced it. It was like this deep yoga breath. It encompassed everything reimagined or reinvention did, but in a more human way. And my goal, my entire goal, is not to astonish people or to, you know, paralyze them, to inspire them with terrifying examples that they couldn't, you know, hope to achieve. My whole goal is to inspire people with, you know, real possible change. And if reimagined is a word that, you know, you could visit, then I'm going to use it. So that's why it's on the front of the book, you know, reimagining the rest of your life.
What about people who really desperately want to change but have fear of the unknown, which so many people suffer from? I mean, some people, like you were talking about, your husband, who don't like change perhaps, but maybe underneath it, for so many people, it's just fear.
Yeah, well, Gary's a little different in that, you know, he doesn't like change, but, you know, he has an underlying courage that enables him to take risks, probably bolder even than I do. So set him aside.
Okay, put him on.
Let's talk about my friend Anne, who is probably my oldest friend at NBC, and she is still working at NBC. Now Anne is 66, and she doesn't like the word reinvention and probably doesn't like reimagine much more. Anne is always talking about getting her ducks in a row. And my sister once teased her, you know, isn't the point getting your ducks in the water? But as I look back and consider all the advice I have given Anne, which she has listened to so patiently and ignored, Anne has gone about her life in a very methodical way, a patient way. She assesses her options. She assesses her status. She does her research. She does her homework. When sometimes change arrives unbidden, she's fearful. But chances are she's ready, and she's gotten herself ready. So I will look for the first off-ramp, and when I think it's time, and I won't really need to know a destination. I just take it. Anne wants to know, well, if I take this off-ramp, where will it lead?
Mm-hmm.
And will I like it there, and am I ready, and what should I be doing? Who should I talk to? And she'll talk to 5 or 10 people and get their advice, and then when she's ready. And looking back, I give Anne credit. That's a way of living. There isn't, my book isn't a must-do, much less a how-to. And the stories, and thank you for in the beginning, you say it's a lots of stories. Mine is one of them. But my goal is that in telling dozens of stories, a reader will find an insight that resonates in a particular way for them. That there, you know, the secret to, I'll go back to the bad word, reinvention, is that there isn't one, or rather there isn't only one.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's really, really the message. Nor is it, you got to do it now. People think, you know, well, everyone's getting, they're all doing these great things, and I'm the only one left behind. We have so much in common with my millennials, my 20-somethings, two of them turned 30 this year, but, you know, at that decade, you know, you think everybody's got it together but you. Everybody's got the career going You know, they know where they're headed. They're started, and you know, and that's not true for them either. We have a lot in common with our children. Just starting out is scary too. Starting again can also be scary. I respect that. I also respect that a lot of people, even my age, still have children at home, or have children who've come back.
Or home. Parents to take
or
care of.
Or parents who are looking after, you know, aging parents who are thinking, you know, it's good for you, Jane, but, you know, as I'm listening to the radio, I'm multitasking because I don't have 5 minutes a day to think of myself. So I recognize that the timing isn't the same for everyone. Not everyone, you know, this is my time maybe. Your time may come, you know, later, and, you know, maybe, I've seen research. This is interesting. People have, in test subjects, when asked to think of themselves in the future, their brain scans light up in exactly the same pattern as when they're asked to think of a stranger. So I think of my book as being about the stranger that is you. Because we don't identify with that person in the future who will be different than we are now. Circumstances will be different. I, more than most, think about that person in the future.
And we need to take another break, Jane.
So I'll take a breath.
Okay.
And we'll come back and talk about some of the stories in the book, because some of them are really
great.
Fascinating.
Okay.
Jane Pauley and her latest book is Your Life Calling, Reimagining the Rest of Your Life. That break, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Jane Pauley, whose book is Your Life Calling, Reimagining the Rest of Your Life.
And she'll be in Miami tomorrow.
And she will be at the Biltmore for the Chamber of Commerce luncheon tomorrow. And they're sold out, but they do have a wait. Excuse me, a waiting list, and you can go to womenschamberofcommerce.org to put yourself on that list. So, Jane, let's talk about some of the stories. I'd like to begin with Jenny Bowen and her husband, the filmmakers, because they're so remarkable, and it's such a remarkable story.
You know, I've never been a person with lots of hobbies or outside interests, which I've been self-conscious about, but if I do have a hobby, it's interpersonal gardening and connecting other people's dots. And so if I'm interviewing someone for one of our stories, I'm really looking for a career path, an explanation for how you got from there to here. And Jenny Bowen, I just didn't get it. She looked so like the rest of us, and yet had created a nonprofit that, and this is unusual, an American nonprofit that was in every province in China, helping them remake their social institutions, the orphanages that we all understand are so problematical. How did she do this? She had grown children, was a filmmaker. She had no more background in child development than I have, raising children, no background in policy or foreign policy. She'd never started a nonprofit, and yet she had done this extraordinary thing. She is revered in China, couldn't put it together until she did it for me and explained everything she needed to create the Half the Sky Foundation. Was she had learned in her either experience as a mother or her career as a filmmaker. She said research. She was very good online before Google was invented. Logistics, casting, creating a script. She summed it up in the most, you know, poetic way. She said, my job was to imagine a world that didn't exist and to make it happen. And that's what she did. And it started with the adoption of their first daughter, Maya. They adopted a second daughter from China, Anya. And
this was when she was in her 50s.
She was in her 50s, and she says she'd already had grown children, but she said the advantage of being an older parent is that you don't have such a burden on your children that they turn out perfect. You just want them to have as happy and productive a life as they can have. But she has, she's done this great thing. So you pick the story of my book that is the most likely to intimidate a listener.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, let's
because the other stories are, they're more, you could see yourself in the picture.
Okay, so talk about Betsy McCarthy. That's a good one.
The knitting champ.
Yes.
Betsy, you know, people associate my book with boomers, and a lot of the stories in the book are people who are a generation ahead, because what I was looking for were people who had been there and done it. And before reinvention was the buzzword that it has become, Betsy was an executive at a healthcare organization on the West Coast, was a policy analyst, had been an English teacher. There was knitting in her briefcase. She said it calmed her. It kept her sane. When she was in her early 50s, she started talking about quitting her job and trying to do something with knitting full-time. And people said, well, you can't do that. That would be career suicide. And she was offered a better job, more money, and she took it. At the age of 57, she finally ditched the briefcase and tried exploring how she would make knitting her full-time occupation. Now, she didn't want to run a knitting store. Starting a business wasn't what her passion was. It was knitting. She describes a period of floundering around. She said something that Matt Lauer quoted when the story was over. She said, sometimes it requires, you know, being comfortable in ambiguity and not panicking in uncertainty. I can do that, but not everyone could.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my first story, which I thought was kind of bold to lead off our, you know, reinvention series with a woman whose reinvention was knitting, but she makes it look like an Olympic sport. And she says they did a lot of downsizing, she and her husband, to make this possible. But at this point in midlife, I think people are kind of comfortable with letting go of the material acquisitions that define success in our earlier selves. Now we're looking for things that, you know, fulfillment and meaning, you know, life that matters, and you know, being creative and engaged. And she's found all those things, and she says yarn doesn't cost very much.
It's great. You know, the story I also liked was Trip Hansen, because I think he echoes so many people when he says, and because maybe a lot of people are listening right now and thinking, oh, okay, what's my passion? And I'm going to look for something else to do. And what could it be? And he said, for me, it never happened when I was looking for it.
You know, for me, it never happened when I was looking, and I was always looking, but it would tap me on the shoulder and be something entirely different. What I have in common with Trip Hansen is the ability to say, well, all right. Trip also said he was at a point in his life, and he was a Broadway actor, dancer, singer, had actually appeared on the Today Show, though I didn't, you know, long ago I didn't know that. He said he realized he was at a time in life when this time it wasn't going to happen if I don't make it happen. I totally identified with that. How he discovered acupuncture, and he's one of only a couple people in my book who literally have found new careers.
Mm-hmm.
But how did he find acupuncture involves telling a story about his little dog and a counselor who had told him, you know, if something interests you, pay attention. You know, just pay attention. Why does that interest you? And this acupuncture for his dog interested him in a way he didn't understand, and he followed through, and he said, you know, it's kind of theatrical. The candles and the lights and the Malamar sometimes that they use, the needles that are kind of mysterious. And he followed it and went back to school, and now he's an acupuncturist, and he's got a career really working mostly with show people, because they always got something that hurts.
That's right. We're speaking with Jane Pauley, and her book is Your Life Calling, Reimagining the Rest of Your Life. We need to take one more short break. Please stay with us, and we'll be right back.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Burton, and we're joined by Jane Pauley. Her book is Your Life Calling. She'll be in Miami at the Biltmore Hotel tomorrow. Jane, the book is a collection of stories and includes yours. And because you included it in the book, could you touch on your bipolarism?
That was a bit of a surprise. I was 50 years old when I was diagnosed. As it was explained to me at the time, it was triggered by the treatment of an unrelated medical condition, which was hives. But the medication for hives, which were causing swelling in my throat, which can kill you, the big guns, steroids, in a person with a history of a mood disorder, or even a family history, the medication would have been given to me with even greater care and probably with a mood stabilizer. But I'd had no known history of a mood disorder or a family history either, though, as everybody understands, family history and family secrets can sometimes be the same thing. I still don't know, but it does tend to have a congenital root. So there I was at 50, and I was, as my doctor told my husband, your wife is very sick. That was 14 years ago, and I got a lot sicker. All I knew about bipolar and manic depression, I really had learned as a journalist, which enabled me to understand it in a way that was very helpful for me. I recognized day one that when I got better, I might be able to help people by telling my story because, and I can document this, I have the newspaper clippings. I was famous for being normal. I think some people use Midwestern and normal interchangeably.
You had such a fresh-faced girl next door kind of appearance.
Yeah, but so it's been 14 years, and I've not had a recurrence, though. It's something I think about every day. I take meds. I pay attention to sleep. I'm on this book tour. I'm traveling, staying in hotels, changing time zones. I have to be mindful of am I getting the right sleep? And, knock wood, if there's anything I can do to prevent a recurrence, I will, though no doctor has really told me that I have a lot of control over that, though I do think having an advocacy role has helped. Michael J. Fox talks about Parkinson's. He says Parkinson's is the gift that keeps on taking. And I think that my ability to do advocacy in mental health is part of the reason I have remained as well as I have, because there's a lot of research that says giving support is as therapeutic as getting it. And so these days I'm not recognized as a celebrity like I was when I was on Today or anchoring Dateline. But when I am recognized, I often know what's coming. And I'm going to have a conversation with someone who either says, I think I have what you have, or my father, or my son was just diagnosed, sometimes I'm the first person they've ever talked to about it. So it's been a real blessing to have been able to contribute to a conversation that helps people to understand that a mental health disorder is a medical disorder. So that's my speech.
You know, coincidentally, I was going to ask you if you're still an advocate for it. And as we're sitting here waiting for emails to come in, this email pops up and it says, Jane Pauley is the powerful mental health advocate. She'll be at the Reflections of Hope Luncheon on February 27th at Boca West Country Club for Jewish Family Services. So I guess you still are a big advocate.
Absolutely. It's a privilege, and an honor. I once got a standing ovation from 100 people who I don't think knew who I was. They were people who were being treated for extremely serious disorders, and I was there to speak at a fundraiser, And as part of their fundraising, they always had the speaker go over and talk. And I'd kept them waiting 10 minutes. So they were real happy to see me finally arrive, and they stood up and gave me the standing ovation. And I had to explain to them who I was. But I said, you know, for today, I'm the president of our club. We're in the same club, and today I'm the president, and we have a lot in common. And it was my favorite part of the day. I was talking to people who all they knew about me, Jane Pauley, was that I had bipolar disorder too, and I was modeling a productive life, you know, an engaged life. I mean, not everybody can stand at the podium and give speeches and, you know, be on NPR and be interviewed, but we can find ways to have creative lives and stay productive and be engaged. You know, no matter what our circumstances, there's hope.
Do you live with, do you have a fear that you'll have a reoccurrence? You said you haven't had one, but do you?
No. Well, my mother was an ovarian cancer survivor. She, in her late 60s, had her first of many major strokes, was an invalid for the rest of her life. My father, who late in life, it was revealed, was an alcoholic. And my sister and I grew up thinking he was a teetotaler, so that was a surprise. That might be the evidence of the, you know, the genetic background, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I knew to expect something. Robin Roberts on Good Morning America has got a book coming out this spring. It's got a title something like Everybody Gets Something, and we've all watched her courageous fight with this and then that. I took for granted that I'd get something, but, like, you know, you never get what you're expecting. So I don't know if I'll have a recurrence or whether, you know, I'll have a diagnosis of something else. But in the meantime, I figure whatever comes my way, good, bad, or worse, I've demonstrated the ability to deal with it, and I have family and friends who are supportive. And one way or another, we'll get through it together as best we can.
Tell us a little about your family life. You've had a long and successful marriage. You have grown children. Is that a big part of the fulfillment you get in your life today?
Well, I'm looking as we speak as a picture of what my friend Katie describes my kidults. You know, the twins have just turned 30. My daughter was engaged on her birthday. Her younger brother, Tom, was engaged last June. So we've got two weddings coming up. You know, real life is what's real in my life. Far more than, you know, than my career, I identify in, you know, my life with them and my husband. The fact is, we've had a death in the family. Gary's already in Florida. My beloved mother-in-law, I couldn't have had a better one.
Oh,
beautiful woman, lived to be 92, and you know, I'm coming down for a funeral. So the whole family's gathering. The clan is gathering. We're coming together to celebrate. You know, I know life is real and loss happens, but boy, was I blessed. I didn't intend to talk about, you know, my mother-in-law, Jean Amory, but she was a great lady, and, you know, I couldn't imagine having a better life than she lived.
Do you think you still might have a stranger or two inside that'll be in your next reimagining?
Oh, you know, I quote a professor in my book more than once. Maybe more than twice. Hermina Abera teaches at Harvard. Her expertise is in careers and transitions, but I extrapolate from her research in the midlife transition. And she says that one of the big misconceptions is that we think there's some perfect self waiting to be revealed, when in fact, she says, everybody has multiple selves, and they emerge in our lives according to opportunity and circumstances. But as she puts it, if it's in you, it wants airtime, and sooner or later will bubble up. And I think that that's the secret of my my book, and the reason that this reinvention strikes a chord that it strikes today is that my generation is the first to get a heads up that for a generation or two, people have been living longer, have been living longer and healthier lives, and that we are more likely to have the opportunity for those other selves to reveal themselves to us.
So, Jane Pauley, we have to run. I just want to tell our listeners that we have a link to your book at both the Topical Currents Facebook page and our website, WLRN.org, and it's certainly been a very pleasant hour to have you.
Thank you for indulging me.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. And again, Jane Pauley will be at the Biltmore for the Chamber of Commerce, Women's Chamber of Commerce luncheon tomorrow. You can go to their website to see if you can get on a waiting list because it's sold out. Jane Pauley, the best of luck to you. Sorry for your loss, and thank you so much for joining us.
Joseph and Bonnie, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And that wraps us up. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information, including book and author links, at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like. Tomorrow's program begins with British sociologist and writer Roman Krznarek. He's written How Should We Live? Great Ideas from the Past for Everyday Life. Also, of course, Linda Gassenheimer and Food and Dining with Fred. And today's calendar on this day in 1904, 110 years ago, the birth of legendary choreographer and composer George Balanchine in St. Petersburg, Russia. He co-founded the New York City Ballet and led it for 35 years. He died in 1983. And on this day in 1973, 41 years ago, George Foreman gains a TKO over Joe Frazier to gain the heavyweight title in Kingston, Jamaica.
Down goes Frazier! Down goes Frazier!
And one more while we recall the Kojak years. On this day in 1994, 20 years ago, the death of actor Telly Savalas at age 70. He was in The Birdman of Alcatraz, The Dirty Dozen, Kelly's Heroes. He was credited for making a bald pate sexy. So we leave with a thought from Telly Savalas, quote, Kojak is the kind of guy who couldn't arrest a hooker. He'd send her home. He operates on instinct. But if you give him any lip, he'll throw you out the window. Coochie coo, baby. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned now for The Here and Now from NPR News.